Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to Season 2 of the Modern Adventurer podcast. I'm your host, John Horsfall. I'm an adventurer and photographer, and each week I'll be talking with a new guest about their latest adventure from around the world. For all the new listeners and subscribers who have joined, I speak to adventurers and explorers who do remarkable things in the field of exploration and endurance. This is an immersive podcast, so this season their story is cut to music and cinematic effects, as we immerse ourselves into the heart of their adventure. My next guest is an award-winning journalist, explorer, and biologist who produces wildlife documentaries. For the past 4 years, he's worked on BBC's A Perfect Planet, a five-part series narrated by Sir David Attenborough. On the podcast today, he shares his passion for the fight to save the critically endangered Javan rhino from extinction. We go with him on his mission to find one of the rarest animals on Earth, an opportunity rarely granted to Westerners to track these incredible animals in their natural habitat. I am delighted to introduce Toby Nolan to the podcast.
Thanks very much, John. It's great to be here.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on, and I cannot wait to sort of get into the story. I listened to your story back in, I think, November of last year, and when I heard it, I knew I had to get you on. And with this new format, I think it's going to be absolutely incredible. But before the podcast starts, I always like to ask you to tell the audience who you are and what you do and how you got into this sort of life of adventures.
Sure thing. Well, I work in TV and film. I make natural history documentaries, wildlife documentaries. I've done that for the last 8-10 years. But long before that, I have spent most of my life trying to find a way to go in search of some of the world's rarest and most endangered animals out there. And as soon as I had the means to try and make that happen, I did so. So I started to lead research expeditions when I got to university and look for ways to fund those expeditions and recruit teams to come with me. So there were lots of different expeditions that I took out. That was the kind of the basis of the most recent expedition, which was to look for the Javan rhino.
Amazing. And so what made you sort of get into this sort of life? What was it from a young age that had you sort of hooked on the Jarvan Rhino or this sort of wildlife stories as you, or documentaries?
Yeah. Well, I remember watching Planet Earth, David Attenborough's Planet Earth on the BBC when I was, God, how, I mean, it was 2011. No, it was a long time ago. I can't remember when Planet Earth was first broadcast, but it was a long time ago. And I was a kid, I was looking on the screen. I just remember thinking, God, that looks like the best job in the world. I'd love to do that. I'd love to work on that. So it was always this sort of festering ambition in my head to try and make it happen. And I knew that Bristol was the global hub for it, the Green Hollywood, where it kind of all happened. So I had to try and sort of base myself nearby and keep petitioning people to try and work in the industry. But going back, I mean, I've always been into animals and the outdoors, and looking for birds and bees and bugs in the garden has always been a mad obsession of mine, and I've always been really, really into all things wildlife. I've been mega geeky about it for most of my life. I used to volunteer with the RSPB when I was 13, and that really got me going, got me into the bird world, and got my first binoculars and started birding. And that built into more and more exciting things further afield. And when I got to Edinburgh University, I discovered the Expedition Club, and they helped encourage you to find a way to organize your own research expeditions. And that's where it all kicked off, really. And for the Jarvan Rhino, that was another very special thing, because that all started when I picked up this I've got this thing about natural history books, about wildlife books. So just everywhere I go, every kind of, you know, charity book sale I see, I go past, I have to grab something natural history. So I've got a house completely full of all these amazing natural history books, most of which I've never read, but I just I love having them around and flicking through them. And one of the ones that I picked up from one of these kind of backyard sales was this book called Last of the Wild by a photographer called Eugene Shoemaker. And within it is, that's Ujung Kulon, this giant forest. They call it the Forest of Giant Palms. And it's this forest where everything underneath it, all the animals are just dwarfed by these enormous plants. And it's an amazing place. Anyway, I just found it amazing to see this, a rhinoceros in a deep jungle like this. And it just set up this thing in my head as this kind of mythical mammal that I really wanted to go in search of. So it sort of never left my head. And then one day I thought, you know what, screw it. Let's start a plan to head out and look for the Jarvan Rhino.
And so how long did this plan take?
I mean, between seeing that photo and between getting out the door was, I guess, best part of 20 years. But in terms of actual planning, I'd say it was kind of two or three years of sort of getting everything together. I mean, the idea of what to actually do for the expedition came from earlier expeditions I'd led to look for other endangered species, to use a similar method of data collection, photo identification, which can be a really effective way to survey critically endangered and very rare animals. So that's what we used for the vaquita porpoise in the Sea of Cortez, Mexico. It works really well with marine mammals, and I thought it could work really well with rhinos, and it turns out it did.
So for context, for people who don't know much about the Jarvan Rhino, it's sort of based out in a very remote island of Indonesia. Can you sort of explain a bit more about that?
Sure. Well, actually, the island itself isn't actually remote. That's the most amazing thing about it, is the entire population is on the island of Java, which is the the most densely populated island on the planet by quite a long way, which is just crazy. It's got the island, it's got the city of Jakarta on it. There's 121 million people on it. And at the same time, in the bottom left, southwest corner, there's this tiny little peninsula, Ujung Kulon Peninsula. And it's one of the last true great wildernesses in Indonesia. It's this extraordinary forest. And it still has its sort of post-Ice Age megafauna still intact. They haven't been hunted out. So part of that are the Javan rhinoceros. And the other thing are these Banteng buffalo, these very rare wild buffalo that live in the jungle as well. And so you've got this incredible juxtaposition in Java of pure wilderness and extraordinarily high population centers. And I always found that amazing, that you could have, you know, jungle rhinos living on an island in Indonesia in this day and age. Just sounded amazing.
So it had taken you 3 years from the sort of concept to getting out there. Well, let's jump into the story. So you were sort of there on your sort of first day. You flew into Jakarta and then probably took the long road all the way down to this peninsula.
Yes, exactly. So you get to Jakarta, overnight in Jakarta, then head all the way down to Ujung Kulon. Then we would overnight in a very small village near the entry to the park. And then we would head deep into Ujung Kulon and towards the Rhino Protection Zone. And this is a very special area that not many people are allowed to go to. So it takes a long time to get permission to go there, very expensive permission to go to this part, rightly so, of course, of the park. So it's a day-long walk through the jungle. So we're winding our way through these very narrow tracks all day to get to this part of Ujung Kulon, and then you're along this incredibly long sandy beach. It's all along the coast there, that jungle. So very wild coast. So even when you're in the jungle, a lot of the time you've got the sound of big breakers, you know, quite close by, because it's this very wild coast that just, the ocean is unbroken all the way to Antarctica, so you've got these big breakers that just roll in. And the jungle is hot and sticky and sweaty and wonderful. That's why I love it. It's a very intense place to be, and Ujung Kulon is no exception. It's a heavy going lowland jungle with lots and lots of mosquitoes and quite high malaria, and so you have to be careful. But it's got its bugs. It's got all its the normal jungle things. So we arrived next to a small, a little river that came off a lagoon, a big coastal lagoon, where we planned to camp. We arrived there at about late in the evening and pitched hammocks between small trees and lit a fire, and planned to head off on the river in search of the rhinos at about 4 a.m. the next day. That night, even within 24 hours, stuff started to happen in quite an extraordinary way, really. So went to sleep to all the sounds, the night sounds of the jungle, you know, the tinkling of frogs and cicadas, nightjars and owls. And I drifted off into sleep, knackered from travel, of course, and woke up at about 4 a.m. with a start, and to this sudden sort of thumping sound outside my hammock. it was like this kind of mini stampede, really loud, crashing through the jungle very close to our camp. And so bleary-eyed, kind of ran outside and went to see Chengluz, who was one of our top trackers, sitting by the fire, quite kind of dazed, looking sort of shocked and uneasy. So I started talking to him. I was like, Chengluz, what's happened? And he basically, that night, he'd gone onto the beach to just sleep, to light a fire and sleep. And I don't think anyone had been to this part of Ujungkulon for a long time. So we were the first humans there for quite a while, I think. So Chengluz lit a small fire, and then he'd woken up with a start in the middle of the night to essentially see a rhino standing over him, snorting, looking at him, and not knowing what he was, very confused. Then the rhino got closer and closer, realised that Chengluz was something suspicious, possibly human, snorted and just ran off with a start. And Chengluz was absolutely terrified. And essentially, what had happened is the rhino had seen Chengluz's fire on the beach and been drawn out of the forest. This is our theory, just by curiosity, swam across the big coastal lagoon that separates the beach from the forest, you know, just to try and come and check out what the fire is. Swam across the lagoon, climbed up onto the beach and walked over to Chengluz and looked over at him. And bear in mind, these animals are extremely shy and were barely seen in the wild for about 50 years. So it's you know, that kind of behavior is just amazing. So it was tantalizing to hear this. And I mean, obviously very scary for Chengluz, but also to think, my God, we've already come that close to a Jarman rhino on night one. And I went down to the beach that morning and could see these fresh prints, these fresh footprints going along the beach towards where Chengluz had his fire. And it was amazing. You could just see these very clear, huge toe pads of rhinos. So that was an exciting start.
How long had it been since in the jungle before you had actually seen your first rhino?
It actually happened pretty quickly. It was within the first week that we had our first sighting. We then had about best part of 2 weeks of nothing because of the rain, largely, and our camp was unusable, and we couldn't really get on the river because the water levels were too high. And when we could, there was no evidence of rhinos. I think it was too high for the rhinos. There was just too much. It was just too much water. There seems to be a happy medium that they liked. So we had our first sighting pretty quickly, within the first week. But then there were kind of gaps after that, long gaps before the next one. And then when the conditions were just right, then we had this wonderful cluster of sightings. And there were about 3 days where we saw two different rhinos, at least one of them every day, which was extraordinary, really, to be able to see the rarest large land mammal on the planet with that degree of regularity was such a treat.
I mean, was there a moment during that trip, you know, where you felt it might all fall apart? You know, when it lashed it down with rain for 2 weeks?
Well, to be honest, that first night with Chengluz when he was on the beach and the rhino came after him, that was pretty good. Nothing happened that night on night one. But then I think about 2 weeks in, so as I said, these canoes are inflatable. And I mentioned this jungle is just completely chocker with spiny palms. So as you go up these waterways, you've got these huge dangling spiny fronds just hanging, draped all over the channels, and you're kind of clearing your way through them. Of course, always nervous about the inflatable canoe underneath you, because there are a lot of saltwater crocodiles there. They love the area. It's very easy for them to get into these rivers. They weren't huge crocs, but there were plenty of them. And at one point we were a couple of miles up, and suddenly one of the canoes just burst. Essentially, it just got caught on a thorn and started taking on water pretty quickly. So we had quite a frantic couple of hours paddling back to camp before one boat was completely, you know, over. Sunken and left for croc food. That was probably the most nervous thing.
And so you're paddling frantically. Wow, God. And so how many, for the sort of audience, how many were sort of in a boat at the time? Was it just two of you on each boat?
Two of us, exactly. There were two trackers and there were two of us. Myself and my friend Kyle McBurney, who was filming the expedition. So I was getting the images for the photo ID, and Kyle was making a film about it. So we each were in a kayak with a tracker. We were amazingly quiet actually as we drifted upstream. It did work very, very well until the boat burst and you start taking on water, and then it all backfires. But we patched it up when we got back to shore. It never really fully recovered, but enough for us to head out, keep heading out, and just keeping an eye on it.
Wow. And so towards the end of the trip, and maybe the last time that you paddled out to see the rhinos one last time, what happened?
The final encounter we had was the best one, without a doubt. The final encounter, we drifted around a couple of corners. It was near the sort of middle of the day. The heat was really starting to build then. It was kind of 9 or 10. I remember a lot of monkeys around jumping over the channels at that point. And I just sort of think we think we're done for the day, and then we round this corner, and then again get the shoulder tap, and Mita had seen this thing in front of us, and we just kind of stop paddling and just drift, and we just see this incredible purplish pink. They're an amazing colour. They're sort of hippo coloured, really sort of deep purple, and this big male rhino just holding itself there in the water, with its chin on the mud on the riverbank, and he was just sort of dozing and farting and puffing and snorting, and we watched him and drifted closer, and then he kind of had a little dip and a bath and washed his head a few times, and we were really close. I mean, we were within 10 meters. The rhino just kind of kept coming closer and closer. And because their eyesight's pretty terrible. Most rhino species' eyesight's terrible. So as long as you're the right wind direct, you know, the right side of them in terms of wind, and they can't hear you, you're super quiet, then you've got a good chance of just being undiscovered. And I assume that was what was happening, because we just had this most incredible hour-long encounter with this male as he did his thing. And I just rattled off a load of pictures. And he became the star of the show, really. And it was wonderful. It was just what it was. I mean, the trackers were at great pains to say this was, in their opinion, the longest recorded encounter with a Javan rhinoceros in the wild. It was a super special encounter. And it was really, really important for the expedition, because I could get such close detailed images of the horn and of the skin folds around the rhino's face, around the cheeks, around the eyes. And it was just really easy after that to be able to compare other rhinos we'd photographed and see, oh yeah, we've seen this rhino on this day and this day and this day. And that was a bit of a game changer as well, because the trackers had assumed, because they hadn't obviously been taking detailed photos like these, they'd been limited to camera traps before these expeditions. That was the whole point of the expedition. They'd assumed that if you encounter a rhino on the river, then it gets so disturbed from the area, because they're so sensitive, that it will leave the area and not come back for a long time. And if you see a rhino again, that'll be a whole new individual moving in, that you would then be disturbed again and moved away. But these images were showing that these were repeat rhinos that we were seeing. So they were not being as disturbed as we were expecting. So they were coming back to rest and relax and wash and bathe in the river, regardless of their previous encounter, regardless of their previous disturbance. So that was really interesting, and it indicated perhaps there are fewer than people were thinking before in terms of using those riverine areas, but also just perhaps they're less sensitive locally to disturbance than had been assumed.
What was the sort of feelings like when you sort of got back to camp from there, and the sort of feelings when you left after experiencing, you know, this incredible, you know, expedition, and you set out and you achieved, if not more than you had ever hoped?
It was completely euphoric. It was absolutely euphoric. I mean, it's very cliche to say it's a dream come true, but it really was just hard to sort of contain my joy or our joy. It was electric, the feeling in the camp after we'd had this first encounter, got these first images, and then it got better and better, and the joy just sort of built, and it was remarkable. I remember the first time when I first clapped eyes on one, that sort of really dark, the one in the darkness there, and in you know, early morning. And I remember just finding it really hard to believe what I was looking at, and thinking, you know, your eyes don't quite allow your brain to process it. I'd searched for them for so long and hoped to see one for so long, and it was such a dream, and all the work that had gone into it to make it happen. And then it was sort of unfolding in front of me. There was this gorgeous, very gentle beast just having his early morning bath in front of us. It was absolutely, absolutely wonderful. Yeah, I'll never forget it.
Wow, what an incredible sort of story. And have you got any plans to sort of go back out there again?
Yeah, I do. I had plans for every year afterwards, but I was there in 2020. I was there in Feb 2020, so just as the COVID pandemic was starting to take effect, and so I had plans to go back that year, and obviously they got cancelled, and then the following year they got cancelled, then the year after that and they got cancelled. Indonesia's only just opened up, so the opportunity has returned to go back to Ujung Kulon, but I'm about to descend deep into a year-long edit for my current film work, so it's going to have to go on hold for a little bit. But yes, I absolutely want to go back for sure.
And with this little peninsula at the bottom of Java, I know that I think there's sort of talk of Java being moved as a capital. Is there a fear that this little peninsula could be threatened by rising sea levels?
I mean it could be. I mean, it's all extremely low level. There's always been a really high tsunami risk there. There's always been a lot of fear about the peninsula being washed away, and the the rhinos being seriously affected by a tsunami, because the peninsula is really low-lying, so sea level rise could affect it theoretically in completely the same way. I haven't heard much on the ground talk about specifically sea level rise affecting Ujung Kulon in the same way. I don't know if it's because the jungle itself offers some level of protection. I don't know. But in terms of tsunami risk and it being low level, you know, it's a stone's throw from Krakatoa. Krakatoa is almost within sight. It's the closest land to Krakatoa. So it was hit. It was affected by a tsunami a couple of years ago. I can't remember how the rhinos fared in that. I know it wasn't catastrophic for them, but there was a small enough tsunami to take out some of the jungle. So that is a fear. There's been talk of airlifting, capturing some of the rhinos, airlifting them out, plonking them on an offshore island as a kind of backup reserve population, a new founder population. I think that plan was abandoned. I know it was abandoned. I don't think it's been resumed or gained traction again. Because it's a sort of double-edged sword for the Javan rhino, because it lives in this incredible habitat that's very intact, and you know, there's an invasive palm, but apart from that, it's really in excellent quality. It's in excellent nick. All of the different niches are acting as they should. The forest fauna is in really great shape, and it's very hard for poachers to reach because it's well protected. It's a peninsula, it's almost an island. There's heavy poaching patrols, and it's very dense, it's very difficult to navigate into. But all of the Javan rhinos are in one place. So you've got all 72 remaining Javan rhinos in one single forest, which is great in that they can find each other and they've got a home that's of great quality, and they're all connected. So it really minimizes the risk of inbreeding and the bad effects that has on genetic diversity of small populations. But it does mean that it does expose them to being very vulnerable to single risks and single incidents. Like you touched on there, be it sea level rise, be it tsunamis, be it you know, any big natural disaster, be it disease outbreaks. So there's always that fear with the Javan rhinos, that one big thing and that could spell disaster. As it stands, they're increasing, actually. They're doing really well in this little forest that relatively small forest where they're remaining. So the last camera trap images from a few years back showed a new calf, which bumped the population up to 72, which is extraordinary. So I think the thinking is that there's nowhere left for them to go outside of that. So they're probably at capacity. You probably can't squeeze any more Javan rhino territories into that forest. But they've filled it up as best they can, you know. So I think the population is doing relatively well.
Yeah, that was actually my question. For the audience who probably don't know just how rare these rhinos are, there are only 62 odd recorded sightings or different numbers. So I just wanted to sort of pinpoint that as just to show how rare these mammals are.
They're super, super rare. Yeah, we didn't really realize how many there were for a long time. So they used to be, until 2011, they were in Vietnam as well. There was a small population up there, different subspecies. And the last one was poached there in 2011. The last one was found decapitated, sadly, and that spelt the end for the Vietnamese Javan rhino, which meant all the remaining Javan rhinos only solely found in Java, of which we know there's 72 remaining. But they used to be extremely widely distributed back when unbroken forest covered most of Asia. used to find them from India up through northern China, across all of Southeast Asia. They had this, they enjoyed this massive distribution. And then slowly, as the world changed and humanity spread across the globe, that habitat was eaten away at, and then came in trophy hunting. And then they were hunted for food, and then there was a lot of war in those regions, and that took its toll on both the rhinos and the forest. And then it's only really the last 40 years that the poaching epidemic has taken hold, and that's what's driven the Javan rhino to the very edge of extinction. And I'm sure everyone knows a lot, you know, plenty about the international poaching trade, but the rhinos are hunted for their horn, which is predominantly made of keratin, which is the same chemical protein which is in fingernails and hair, human fingernails and hair. They're hunted for their horn, and it has been for various uses, but currently the biggest use is for parties in China. And it's used as a kind of a hangover cure, both a party drug and a hangover cure. It's kind of ground into a liquid and just drunk as a hangover cure. I don't imagine it works, but that's what's been driving them to the very edge, and is still driving them to the very edge, and means that their situation is still extremely precarious.
You said, though, that the females don't have the horns. Do you think that's probably one of its successes, why they haven't? I mean, they're so close to extinction, but do you think that's maybe something that's helped?
I don't know for sure, but I don't think so. I think the rhinos are hunted regardless. And, you know, if a rhino is hunted without a horn, they might not, you know, I would bet that poachers wouldn't know that until the rhino's dead in front of them, and at that point it would just be bad luck for them that they would have a rhino with no horn. But the females, actually, they don't have a horn, but I believe there's still a bit of, there's a sort of nubbin there, there's a kind of just a sort of basal part of a horn. They don't have an actual horn, so to speak. I mean, the male horns are tiny. This is a species, it's one of the only two species on Earth to have one horn, in common with the Indian one-horned rhinoceros. And the one horn they do have is very small. You know, it's usually around 10 centimeters. So it's nothing like the big horns of the black and white rhinos of Eastern Africa, Eastern and Southern Africa. It's nothing like that. So the kind of rewards for a poacher are minuscule. So it's remarkable, really, but it's extremely valuable. It's still rhino horn is still the most valuable commodity on planet Earth. It's still more valuable than gold, diamonds, and silver, than any jewel, gram for gram. Yeah.
Toby, it's been an absolute pleasure, like, listening to your stories, and it's just incredible to sort of hear about, you know, this such a rare species. But there's a part of the show where we always ask the same five questions to each guest each week. And the first one being, what does it mean to have purpose?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think for me, I mean, I guess that's a very subjective question, isn't it? It's going to be different for everyone. I think we live in a world of great environmental crisis, and we've been in a state of biodiversity crisis for as long as I've been alive. But it's never been more pressing and never been more important and more urgent for us to address than now. So, and I think the biodiversity crisis in hand with the climate crisis is, for me, the most pressing of all things on planet Earth. And I think you know, if we don't sort our environmental woes out, then we're not going to last. We're not going to survive. We're not going to be able to live in the world we want to live in, our species and almost any other. So for me, being able to do and go on these incredible adventures has to meaningfully in some way contribute towards, go some way towards helping that and helping remedy that crisis. And that might be in part through collecting relevant data, and also might be in part through trying to raise as much awareness as possible about specific issues and inspire motivation in other people to make change as well. And that's as important as it gets for me.
Amazing. And what about your favorite quote?
This is a quote from Henry David Thoreau, Walden, or Life in the Woods. "We need the tonic of wildness. At the same time that we are earnest to explore and learn all things, we require that all things be mysterious and unexplorable, that land and sea be indefinitely wild, unsurveyed and unfathomed by us, because unfathomable. We can never have enough of nature." And that sums it all up for me.
What about your favorite travel book and why?
My favorite travel book. Yes, my favorite travel book is Into the Heart of Borneo by Redmond O'Hanlon. It's this wonderful romp through the Bornean jungle in search of the Sumatran rhino. Actually, it's not far off. It was actually one of the inspiring books for me to go and search the Javan rhino. But I've read this book 3 or 4 times, and it's just written so well, and it's very funny, and it captures all the wonderful details of living with people in the jungle in Borneo and traveling through the Bornean jungle. And I've spent a lot of time in Borneo and in Malaysia and in Indonesia, and I absolutely love it. It's very easy for me to connect with that incredibly rich and exciting part of the world by diving back into that book. So I absolutely love that.
Nice. Why are these adventures important to you?
I mean, I guess that comes back to this idea of trying to do something to remedy the state of the world. You know, everywhere we look, biodiversity, wildlife is in trouble. And I think we have a responsibility to, we surely have a responsibility to protect and preserve life on Earth as much as we can. I mean, I guess there's an argument that some people say sometimes, and I've often thought about it, that you know, everything is in flux, and life, that, you know, there's always been extinction events and life comes and goes on planet Earth, but surely we have within us a moral or an ethical, I feel like we still have a moral or an ethical responsibility to preserve life on Earth. I mean, would we be poorer or richer if the Javan rhino went extinct? I guess you could argue that a lot of people wouldn't know the difference. Your life would go on unaffected, but the world would be a lot poorer. The world surely is a richer, more interesting, more inspirational place with animals like the Javan rhino and with the vaquita porpoise. You know, these are animals that don't have a functional, they don't have a kind of great function in our day-to-day lives. But if you let them go, then where does it stop? Where do you draw the line? You know, where do you say, okay, well, the vaquita didn't matter, but the honeybee does? You know, I think we are part of such an intricate web on this planet, of such an interdependent, intricate web of millions of different species, And we have no idea where we slot in, really, and how dependent we really are and how dependent other species are on each other. And as soon as you start removing those building blocks, you know, and taking out the pieces of Jenga, then you don't know when it's going to topple and you don't know what's going to happen. So I think at every turn we have a responsibility to save life and preserve other species on the planet.
Very true. And in your lifetime, where's the most memorable place you've been and why?
Oh, that's a really good one. Do you know, the most memorable place is probably the depths of the Gobi Desert in the middle of winter. We were going to film the last wild camels. There's only about 500 left for a BBC series went out a couple of years ago called A Perfect Planet. And it was just extraordinary. It was 5 days travel from Ulaanbaatar, the capital, down through Mongolia into the Gobi. And it was about minus 50 Celsius at times with wind chill, absolutely just frigid cold. And everywhere you looked, it was like a Martian landscape. I've never been anywhere that looked less like this planet than the heart of the Gobi. It was just black shale as far as you can see, very little vegetation at all. And yet one of the largest mammals on the planet, the wild camel, still survives there somehow. And we were filming it as it looks for snow, and it's extremely shy and extremely hard to get close to. But that really stuck out for me. That was an incredible place. I was very lucky to go there.
Wow, sounds incredible. Yeah, we had a few people on the podcast who went through the Gobi, and everything they said about the Gobi is just all about strangeness and just oddities within it. You know, sometimes we had Ash Dykes who talked about like the silence and how you could even like hear your body function in a sense.
That's lovely. Yeah, I like that.
Amazing. And what, Toby, what are you doing now, and or what are you doing next, and how can people follow you with these sort of adventures that you do in the future?
Well, I'm about to dive into this edit on this series, as I said, so I might not be on expedition for a little while, but do keep an eye on my Instagram, and I will be blogging about it. Instagram is always the best way, and I'll put news out about that. I always start a new blog or a new website when it comes to a new journey or a new adventure. So yeah, Instagram's the best way.
Amazing. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure listening to your stories, and I cannot thank you enough for coming on today.
You're very welcome.
And I'm sure the audience absolutely loved hearing about the Javan Rhino.
Well, you're very welcome. And if anyone wants to know more about it, they're very welcome to get in touch. Just ping me a message.
Amazing. Well, there you go. Well, again, thank you so much, and look forward to following your adventures in the future.
Great, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and don't forget to subscribe and review the podcast if you're listening on Apple. A massive thank you to those who reviewed it. And I hope to see you next week for another fascinating tale of adventure. But till then, have a great day wherever you are in the world, and happy adventures.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all-purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now. Save big money.